Maybe I'm in love with you. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you. You put your arms around me, I'm in love with you. You say that you believe me, that our love is true. I say maybe.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so pleased to have Bob Hickok joining us via phone from Blacksburg, Virginia. Bob, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for being on the other end of the line today.
Sure. Good to be here.
And a big thanks, before we get started with the conversation, a big thanks to the fabulous Yulees for the last 3 weeks of Living Writers. Amanda Yulee hosted with Frank Yulee Engineering. And if anyone out there missed any of these episodes, you can listen to the shows on Living Writers' website. So I just wanted to give a big thanks to Amanda and Frank Yulee. For taking us through the holidays times and kicking off the new year in style. And now, Bob, you and I have to try to continue that, and Stephanie behind the glass. Are you game?
Sure.
Okay. So we've got your latest book of poems, Hold, here, and we're going to get to hear some of these poems later in the hour. Before we get started, I'll just read your short bio from the back of Hold. Hold is Bob Hickok's 9th collection. His 7th book, Elegy Ode, Copper Canyon Press 2013, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. This Clumsy Living, University of Pittsburgh Press 2007, was awarded the 2008 Bobbitt Prize from the Library of Congress and published in German translation by Lux Books in 2013. His other books include Sex and Love, Words for Empty and Words for Full, Insomnia Diary, Animal Soul, and There's More. He is the recipient of 8 Pushcart Prizes, a Guggenheim, and 2 NEA Fellowships. His poetry has been selected for inclusion in 9 volumes of Best American Poetry. He teaches at Virginia Tech. And I love your book, Hold, Bob. How long was this one in the making? What's the story of this book?
No real story. They pretty much take about 3 years, or I have 3 years between books.
Is it part of your process that you're always writing or so?
Yeah, I write every day. Every day, unless we're traveling, I finally learn to not write while we're traveling.
Really? So does it feel like it's almost something like a compulsion? Like even if you're on holiday, it's just something you would want or need to do?
Yeah. Far more want, although want at a certain point I think is indistinguishable from need. I wake up really early, typically 4:30, 4:35.
Ooh.
And I don't need an alarm to do it. I'm just really eager to get up and write. And I do that, and once I do that, I don't really care what happens the rest of the day.
Because you feel like you?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what it is. There's some kind of calibration that goes on, or just being in my right skin. And if I do that, I by and large can roll with anything that happens. If I don't do that, it doesn't take that long before I really need to do that or others are going to regret it.
So it's an outward facing rage, Bob.
I think it faces every direction that it can. Do not sell my rage short.
I shall not. I shall not. So how long have you, like, were you always, like, even as a kid, you weren't always that eager, right?
No.
How did this happen for you, to you?
I'm one of those people that came to this relatively late. I was not a reader when I was younger. I was a math and science guy, and about the time I turned 20, and my girlfriend broke up with me, I started writing. I got a notebook from a drugstore and just needed to speak of my broken heart.
Oh,
and that's really where it started for me.
I'm sorry. Both, just so you know, because you can't see us, but both Steph and I were like, oh, when you said, like, this is how it started, we're both sad.
Well, I think that makes me like the majority of people who've ever done this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, because, well, did you... I guess, yeah, for me, it was like there was something similar too. Although I was writing always as a little kid, but dumb stuff and drawing. But then I think when my dad died, I started writing some poems, and they felt more like, oh, this is something that's its own thing, which
yeah,
was the
sense.
First feeling of that, really.
How old were you when he died?
I was 21.
Okay. Pretty young.
But that didn't mean, but unlike you, I didn't like, because now I feel like the next part of your story is that, and then you just wrote and wrote, and then every 3 years you had a new manuscript. Like, is that what happened? Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. Walk us through a little bit of this.
Which part of this?
Well, okay. Well, so I feel like when you were 12 years old, I read in an interview that you had, tell me if this is way off base, but you're like, don't hold back, Bob. Was it a formative experience at the Green Mill in Chicago?
I had a formative experience there, but not at 12 years old. A number of laws would be broken,
right? Because it's a bar. Yeah. Let's be honest.
It's kind of first time that I read elsewhere. I mean, the first readings I did were at open mics in Ann Arbor. The first time I read somewhere else was in Chicago at the Green Mill, which is where the Poetry Slam started. And it was a really interesting experience, in part because at one point after the reading, someone was talking to me and telling me how much they loved my poems. Behind me, someone was talking to someone else about how much they hated my poems. So I was squeezed between the poles of possible response to doing this in a public way. And I just found that really, really compelling. Another interesting thing that happened at the Green Mill for me was watching a guy named Mark Smith, who is the guy who started the Poetry Slam, read. And he began up on this very small stage. It was raised maybe a foot. Began at a microphone, reading a poem he had memorized. He stepped down, kept reading, didn't really need the microphone, jumped up on the bar, walked across the bar, continued reading, jumped off the bar, left the bar, left the building, stood out in the middle of the street, and this is a big street in Chicago, I forget which one, and he was basically reading to traffic. We watched him gesticulating and whatnot, came back in, walked through the crowd, still performing the poem, came up on stage, turned to face the mic, and right as he turned, he hit the last word of the poem, and that was it.
Wow.
Yeah, clearly something he had done before, but it was so compelling to watch performance versus reading, and I have never been a performer, but I really enjoyed watching that. And the Green Mill is a bar that shows up now and then in movies.
Yes.
If you watch many movies, you have probably seen it at some point.
Because I've gotten to go there once, but I wasn't there for poetry. Unfortunately, it was even a little bit earlier, middle of the day kind of thing, I guess. But isn't that where Al Capone was? Or
I don't know.
Or someone had... okay. Well, we want... some listener out
we
there knows.
We could just decide that he was.
Yeah. There's some exciting, even like, but that's exciting though. This idea of this seeing this person who, because you hear about poetry being meant to be allowed, meant to be in a like with people, right, in community, like with that mm-hmm. energy, and then as this public thing as well, right? Yeah. And then this like Mark Smith, the founder of the Poetry Slam in Chicago, was he lived it.
He really did. He had been a trumpet player too, and a boxer.
Oh,
so he had amazing combination of things, all of them with a public performative aspect to them. And I am much more the kind of person who prefers just to read by myself. I want a book. I don't like going to readings. They don't do that much for me. But I'm really compelled by people who are on that side of things.
Wait, what do you mean when you say, well, you, the people, like more Poetry Slam people,
yeah.
or is that
performers?
Okay.
Yeah.
So not that you necessarily, well, but right before we came on the air, you had said you brought the Poetry Slam back to Ann Arbor.
I didn't bring it. What was his name? Forgetting his name. A friend of mine brought it from Chicago to Ann Arbor, and then he headed west, and I took over running the Poetry Slam. I ran it for a couple years, and then it went to other folks. I don't know if it's still going or not, but it used to go on in the Heidelberg.
Oh!
Upstairs in the Heidelberg.
Oh, okay.
Which could hold more than 200 people, and there were occasions when we had overfilled that space. It was pretty amazing.
Oh, I love that. Oh, wow. Well, I'm gonna find out. The Heidelberg, thankfully, is still there. Not everything is, as you know,
yes.
here in Ann Arbor. Some of the great spots are disappearing, but the Heidelberg is there. Getting back to you and writing books, Bob. With this, when did you first like publish? Because I was also asking you really briefly before we went on air, if you'd ever self-published or, and I don't know, could you
sure.
talk about this?
Sure. The first book I published was called Bearing Witness, and it came about after I sent some poems to a guy named M.L. Liebler, who taught and perhaps still teaches at Wayne State, I don't know.
Yes.
I'd seen his name in the newspaper, and I was tired of writing in isolation. I didn't go through a workshop, so I did not have people who were looking at my poems. And I sent him some poems and just asked him if he had the time. Could he give me any sense of what he thought of them? And his response was that he would like to publish a book. So he offered me the chance to publish with a press he ran called Ridgeway Press. And I did that.
What an amazing opportunity.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty cool.
And also so brave to like you're like you said you were isolated. You saw his name in the newspaper.
Yes.
And you were brave enough to just try.
Well, you say brave, I say pushy. But I think we'll go with yours.
Okay. Yes, because this is your hour, Bob.
I don't know. I've never quite understood the notion of brave with this stuff. But it may be in part that I've, throughout doing this, and when I was in undergrad, I did show some poems to people at my school. Mm. And most of them, there were two, husband and wife, that I would take poems in and we'd talk about them. There was another person who taught there, and I decided to seek his opinion. His opinion was, I don't know what these are, but they're not poems.
Ooh.
So I've always had, pretty much at every point in doing this, I've had people telling me very positive things about what I do, and people telling me very negative things about what I do. So the notion of sending some poems to someone who teaches at Wayne State, it, the worst he would have said is, I don't know what these are, but they're not poems. And I would not have liked that, but life would have gone on.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk more and maybe hear some of the poems from Hold.
All right.
Okay. Today on Living Writers, Bob Hickok joins us from Blacksburg, Virginia via phone. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass, and we'll be back.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not, oh no. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, when out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs, or ands, or buts. They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening. I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard?
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Bob Hickok joins us via phone from Blacksburg, Virginia. Bob, thanks for choosing the Joni Mitchell song.
Sure, and I could hear it.
You could.
I was very happy about that.
Oh, brilliant. I'm so glad we got to hear the part about the genius. So, thanks for picking the songs. Why Joni Mitchell?
I just love her music. The people who I am most influenced by are singer-songwriters. I mean, I did not read poetry as a kid, but I listened to music, and she's amazing.
And she's also funny.
She is.
So I can see why that would also light things up for you as well.
Because
that's what you're able to do with poems, is to be both serious and funny, sometimes in the same poem, sometimes not, but always feeling like there's something that's also, it's not necessarily, it's never, this is going to sound sort of strange, it's not like it's ever superficial humor. There's always something else going on. There's playfulness, like that's also part of it, and wordplay or turns and things. But I don't know. Have you always been funny, Bob?
I don't know how to respond to
I know, that was kind of a long rambling.
I'll say yes.
Yes.
I came out of the womb hilarious. It's, the hesitation for me is that I don't think of humor, or actually any part of these poems or conversation, is distinct from any other. Our minds go in the directions they go. I think people who do what we do are allowed to, asked to, insist upon removing some of the stops between things our minds do. So the parts of poems that people may think of as humorous, and they may seem like I tried to get them in there, they're just a natural part of considering any topic. It would come up in any conversation for me. I might go from saying something that seems kind of funny to talking about something that is really, really serious. And they wouldn't seem separate to me.
So this is kind of your natural rhythm.
It was my work really opened up for me when that kind of fullness came into my poems. I think it wasn't until humor showed up. I don't know that I was consciously trying to keep it out, but it arriving was one of the things that I think allowed me to open up in a deeper way.
And you're not afraid to use observations and material that's just you're very close to who you are. Like it is who you are.
Yeah. I think that's part of writing every day. At least for me, I tend to write about what is right in front of me. Whatever I'm thinking or feeling, whatever is most immediate, that tends to get my attention.
Or if you notice that you've walked by a homeless person twice.
Yes.
That becomes something that your mind returns to.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Particularly in that town. That's a
poem
set in D.C. It's a feature of pretty much every large American city. You find yourself doing this, but it's doubly painful, ironic, however you want to look at it, in that city, given what it represents for us.
Do you want to read that one, since we're talking about it, Bob?
Sure. I have to find it.
In the arc, it's page 34, but I don't know if it's the same page. Yes, it is, 34.
Read this in ages. Nature versus murmur. Guy sleeping soundly on the sidewalk on the west side of the Portrait Gallery in D.C. People thronging by, going home or to Zetinia. Fantastic food from Lebanon, Turkey, Greece. Barefoot, the guy, not the fattoush. Ugly toenails, like oatmeal dried under a heat lamp and hammered as far away from symmetry as possible. Though his hands were folded under his right cheek in a cliché of sleepy peace. I consider him a relative of the pileated woodpecker, a statistically rare but not infrequent sight, one of those things in wrong places we accept, ships in bottles, crooks in office, nipples on men. Yes, I noticed that word too, thing. And want to verb it. The thinging of people is slow, like arsenic. Poison you can be slipped in littles without getting hip to your imminent demise. The homeless shock wears off, the tendency to reach and offer. To think of my own bed in three sets of sheets, all the same color because I'm boring. It's just, you know, a dude sleeping on the street a few blocks from the White House. No biggie. And what would I do anyway? Give a crap, buy him some tzatziki, which was great. The lentil doohickeys, not so much. I'm eating a bowl of Raisin Bran trying to finish this poem. The cereal's just there on top of the fridge. The fridge just there in the kitchen. The kitchen just there in the dream of my life. Though I am nowhere, you are not. How do I orient myself to the universe, I am asking? Is it a matter of falling in love with something small like dust or vast, like the totality of gestures the desperate, the clingy atoms make? I thought at the start of this I'd be helpful or insightful. In one erased passage, I invoked Tocqueville. In another, there was a peacock, a Statue of Liberty, a transcription of fanfare for the common man into commas and exclamation points. But here I am turning to you, asking, can you help me out? Lend me some understanding of how I could walk by this guy not once but twice, not in some future but this life, not in theory but in fact, without, that's it, without.
Thanks, Bob.
Sure.
So I think this is like one of the poems that got me sort of crying on the bus. Thanks a lot.
You're the crazy woman on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Many a day.
She really hates the bus.
Right. Such clear misery. Always holding that one book called Hold. But so much is, so you haven't read this poem in a while, you said, at the top of this. So what's it like being, is it like being reunited in some way, or are you surprised?
I'm hesitating because what I'm about to say will seem rude given what you just said.
Because you hate it?
I hate my poems.
What?
I have this weird relationship with my poems. And typically, about the time a book comes out, I really, really hate it. So everything I had picked out to read, except for one poem, is not from that book.
Oh.
It's just the way it works for
me. How curious.
Pardon me?
How curious.
I don't know. I wonder if it's common. I don't encounter it, but I think because I feel it so strongly.
Well, hate is a strong word. Like, some people will be like, well, it takes a long time for it to get published, so I really am on to the new things, you know.
No, I don't like my poems. I like writing them. I feel incredibly strong. I feel kind of invincible while writing. And then I tend to like them a lot for a period just after I've written them. But down the road, I don't care for them. So my books are immensely troubling. It's mostly a hate-hate relationship with them. So, and yet I still believe in what is said in that poem.
You do?
I do. It's just kind of weird to actually encounter it as a poem.
Does it feel too, because your poems aren't like this, but does it feel too contained or something?
No. Honestly, I think what it is for me, I want to be able to write every kind of poem.
Yeah.
And I want every poem to be every kind of poem. So it's hard for me to pick up any poem, at least my own. I don't do this with other people's. I pick up my own poem, and if it seems pretty straightforward, I'll think, that's kind of boring. And if it's kind of strange, I'll think, yeah, it's just, it's weird, but it doesn't say anything. If a poem comes to a clear point, I'll find a problem with that. I want them to do everything, and there's no poem that can do everything all poems can do. But
how good that you actually have the timing down, that you're able to get them out in the world before that feeling overcomes you.
Yes.
You know, because I think that's critical.
Yeah, it's contradictory. If I feel this way, it's like, well, why publish? But I am very connected to the notion of us speaking to each other, and this is the way that I speak to others. I remain conflicted about the product, but not the process. The good thing is that ties me even more to writing. There's this sense that, well, maybe next time, maybe this next poem, maybe this next book will be the one that kind of gets me over this hump. And I don't think there is any getting over it. But it's been an interesting relationship to have with my own work.
And you'll let me know if that happens, would you? Be on the short list.
Okay, I'll call you like 1:30 one night. Yeah. It happened!
Yeah! Amen, brother. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back. We may or may not hear more poems from Hold, though, right? Today on Living Writers, Bob Hickok joins us via phone from Blacksburg, Virginia. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Bob Hickok is here, well, via phone, joining us from Blacksburg, Virginia, where Bob tells me the weather is quite pleasant.
Let's just talk about Ricky Lee Jones now.
Yes! Thanks for picking this one. So why Ricky Lee Jones?
Similar reasons. Her writing is astounding to me, particularly this album, which I haven't listened to in a very long time, but I think I will again. I've had a problem for decades where songs will get stuck in my head and keep me awake. Oh. But I seem to be getting over that. And she, too, is just an astounding writer.
And you know what? So she, yes, I agree. I was just thinking, though, I thought maybe you went to bed early because of part of your process of waking up to write. I just kind of pictured you having a good relationship with sleep, but
not so much.
Don't make assumptions, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, so in your process, you probably don't have music playing. You're probably what's it like?
For about 15 years now, I've either listened to an Eric Satie disc or the Colton Concert by Keith Jarrett, neither of which has words. And I enjoy them a lot, and at this point they're pretty much burned into my head.
And is it something about the like the feeling that's evoked, that's something useful? Or?
Yeah. The Jarrett I find very moving at different points in that concert. There are no lyrics, but there are a couple points where he starts kind of moaning along to what he's doing in a way that's interesting. And the Satie is just so playful.
Oh.
He was a strange guy. If you want to have fun sometime, look for his notes, basically his liner notes. He was a strange guy, and the notes that he made for some of his music, they're fascinating. His titles are odd. It's just this squirrely dude.
Well, the best people are. Potentially, right? I don't know.
I hope.
Yeah, me too, Bob. So when you're drafting a poem, you start and you don't. It's not like, do you know where you're going? Because some people do, or is it something about discovery and finding out? Or
bingo. Yeah, I don't even use the word drafting. To me, this is a performative art. Not like in the Mark Smith sense, but more in the sense of athletics.
Oh, okay.
I sit down and basically I think I'm trying to capture where a representation of my mind in the moment that I'm writing. And I've come to believe very much in that process. And most of my poems, I mean, they either work or they don't. I tend not to revise them. Some I do a lot. But for the most part, they work or they don't. And there's a group of folks who write this way. It's just, it tends not to be something that's discussed a lot. The common approach that people talk about, particularly with poets, is the many drafts. Revise, 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 which I think is a wonderful way to go about doing this. But for some of us, it simply doesn't work. I find the more I do that, the more I kill what is there. I get farther and farther from some living essence that almost requires that some of the mistakes, some of the things that aren't quite right, remain, because that's the way the moment lived.
That's actually quite a powerful thing to think about, like, 'cause it is like like being alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So to have the poem be alive, like you were saying, like a living essence,
yeah,
it requires these mistakes within it.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. I mean, you said mistakes. I don't mean to be harsh.
No, no, that's fine. Cause I think, I mean, they often are, or they can be viewed that way. I think someone who does this the way I do lives midway between first word, best word, and revise, revise, revise. It's just that the revision goes on while you're writing. I will change a lot in the time that I'm writing a poem. In the making of it. The editing and the making are pretty much side by side. And I think this evolved because I didn't have that much time to write. And if I wouldn't finish a poem,
right,
I would feel terrible until I got to write again. But by the time I came back to it, I was a different person.
Yeah, and the living essence, it's almost like you can't find it if it wasn't somehow there from that structure.
I was not a big fan of John Lennon's music. But one of the things that he said that I...
True confessions, Bob.
Yeah. I forget in what context, but he strongly recommended if you start a song, finish it.
Oh.
Because you will never... It's such a simple thing. I think we tend to make this a larger statement that it is. You will not be the same person. You go 5 seconds down the road, you're a different person than you were 5 seconds ago. And certainly if you, the next day, the next week, a month later, it's hard to recapture the mood that existed while you were making the thing.
Yeah, it's also, I don't know, it could also be music or something, but not music makes it sound too precious, but something else that's like the energy or something in it.
No, music, I think, is appropriate in a different, maybe a larger way than we tend to refer to it in poetry. There is an ideational rhythm, an emotional rhythm that any poem is going to have, that once you get out of it, it can be hard to get back there. So.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes things can seem so very clear, and then they can be gone.
Yeah.
So when you were saying having the time to write, was that because when I was reading about you, Bob, I read that you worked in the automotive dye industry. I thought that seemed really interesting.
Yeah, I designed automotive dyes for about 20 years. So I had a day job, and I would write initially after that, and then later I would write before I worked. So I did not have a whole lot of time to devote to poetry.
And you had this dedication, and you have books published. And I think also you mentioned that... you talked with Keith Taylor at a certain point, like telling him, like he knew about you getting the book, your first book published, and saying that was kind of an unusual occurrence with Ridgeway Press in Detroit, with M.L. Liebler, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you, I guess I just wondered, could you talk a little bit about that story? Like, cause you, it sounds to me like you may have resisted Keith's advice. Keith Taylor, friend of the show, giver of great advice.
Also my former neighbor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We lived on Linwood, just like a street over from his house for quite a few years. And so I got the first book by sending some poems to M.L. Liebler. And I went into Keith's store and was talking to him and said something like, I really liked that experience. I'd like to do that again. And he laughed at me and said, you need to publish individual poems. And he sent me over to the Hopwood Room. And I went in there and, not going to get her name right. I think, was it
Andrea?
Yeah, Andrea.
Yes, she just retired, Bob.
Yes.
Yeah, so
I read it.
Andrea Beauchamp.
A couple of years ago, and she was pretty much ready to, said she was about ready to retire. So I talked to her. Of course, that room has that huge table filled with literary magazines, and I started looking at them, and I would come over there periodically. And it's because of that that I started sending two magazines, which really is about the best thing people can do, not just send to them, but read them, because that's the thing that challenges you. I think most of us end up encountering work through magazines that make us feel small in ways that are really helpful, that make us want to try harder, and that certainly went on for me.
Wow, so it makes you want to try harder.
Yes. Yes, I think if you have found the thing you really want to do, putting aside whether you're good or bad at it, encountering someone who is good at it will probably challenge you to work harder. And that still goes on for me when if I really like a poem, it tends to make me feel insufficient in ways that are actually really positive, and not just increase my appreciation for that poem, but make me want to get up the next day and push.
And are there any poems that you're thinking of when you're saying this, like recently, or?
That tends to come and go. Tends to be different people, different poems. Someone recently who I have not looked at in a long time, and I started looking at her again, and I'm very impressed with what she does. It's a very quiet kind of work. Is a woman named Ruth Stone.
Oh yes, yes.
I like her poems a lot. I have a Darwish poem.
Oh yeah.
That's been floating around my desk. That they would love to see me dead. I don't know if you know that poem. It has that effect on me. I'm just so taken with it that it makes me strive.
I think, is the Darwish book, is it also out with Copper Canyon Press? That one?
I don't know. Remember them, I think I remember them sending one. This is actually just one that I copied out of a book. And some poems I copy and they sort of float around, pop up. Get covered by other papers, come back a couple of years later.
Just when you might need them.
Yes.
and of course, I think, Bob, what you were mentioning earlier when you said you walked into Keith's shop, that would have been Shaman Drum.
Yes. Yeah, and this was when it was upstairs.
Oh, okay.
Before it moved downstairs and, of course, before it went away.
It is so lovely hearing hearing parts of your intersections with Ann Arbor, you know?
It's a great town. Well, seems to be multiplying restaurants at an alarming rate. It's like they go have sex with each other and little baby restaurants get formed.
You're right, because many of them are owned by the same people. Well, let's take a short break, and then could you read one of a poem you want to read when we come back, Bob?
Sure.
Does that sound good? Okay.
Sure.
So today on Living Writers, what's the name of the show? Bob Hickok, his book Hold, out with Copper Canyon Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Steph behind the glass. Short break.
Turn me on.
Welcome back after a little more Joni Mitchell there. Today on Living Writers, Bob Hickok joins us.
Good choice.
That was all Stephanie. She's brilliant. anyway, joining us via phone from Blacksburg, Virginia, Bob Hickok here. Bob, is there a poem that you'd like to read?
Sure. I wouldn't say I'm stuck up, just stuck. Once again, I tried to meditate, sit still, and be a poppy full of sun. First, I stared at my closed eyes with my closed eyes. Then I recalled some lab coats gave Molly to octopuses. That most days, I'm trying to jump out of my body without a parachute. One octopus got so high it turned white, not honky, but apple blossom. I wondered about the ethics of not including me in the experiment. I thought that was armist. I only have two, but that's enough for applause and robbing banks. I remembered Molly makes you want to adore stop signs with your mouth, that you believe you're a river walking to 7-Eleven for more Cheetos, which is to say that once again my mind chased the squirrel of itself. I would not say it's humanly possible for me to be happy. Too many of my thoughts are hands caught in table saws. At least I set a record of 22 seconds before I decided smashing a guitar is more honest and peaceful. My favorite bit is when the strings thwang and guffaw in unison. I hear my breath saying its name in that song. I wish I had the courage and guitars to actually be in that band. Mostly I make no progress in any direction, either toward or away from ease. You know what they say. It's easier to tread water with your bones on the bottom of the sea.
Ooh, it's easier to tread water with your bones at the bottom of the sea?
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is not true.
Well, it seems to be saying the opposite, which is always feels sometimes the real truth. Thanks for reading that one. When did you write that one?
I don't recall. Fairly recently, but I forgot about that one. I was looking through poems, trying to decide what to read, and came across that one, and I liked it.
What do you like about it?
It seems to hang together, which is first requirement. It seems to be of a piece, even though it moves in different directions. There are things that are still surprising to me.
Mm.
I think in particular this smashing the guitar. I think that my favorite bit is when the strings thwang and guffaw in unison. I hear my breath saying its name in that song. I think that, maybe more than anything else, it feels like I God, it's something essential about my being in that line. So I'm good to go. I don't need anything more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, thanks for also trying to say what it is about it.
Sure.
Because I know that's not always easy.
It's not, but I think we can do a better job of that than we will often say. I know I tend to retain almost a physical memory of poems that I've written. And I can generally, if not speak to what was going on when I wrote them, I think I can identify the passages that say something to me and take a step away from that and put it into other language.
Mm.
If you can't do that, you can't really read poems. It's a requirement of the job. And I know teaching gets you used to doing that. And it certainly gets me accustomed to doing that.
So that's like some... Forgive me if I'm trying to... I don't mean to like try to make this right or something, but it seems like there's some redemptive quality or feeling then that you can have as you look at each of your books from the past. Because if you're able... I mean, it's almost like your public... real diary or something, like a way of being in the world in the best way you can be.
To some extent, there is a half-life to these things. There are some poems that persist, that I could open any book I've written and pick out probably a handful of poems that I still believe in.
Oh.
But it the number goes down over time.
Over time. Oh. So you need to get a collected together, right? Like someone at Copper Canyon is listening, is going to...
Yeah, collected is about the last thing I want to do. I would a selected that is really, really, really thin.
Oh, that's what I meant. Selected. So,
yeah.
Whoops, I got the wrong.
It's all right.
Yeah, but yeah, selected, like where you're choosing it. It's not everything.
Yeah, I have thought about that. If I was to do one, I would want it to be really thin. The tendency is to kind of beef those books up, and I kind of like the idea that I would have to make myself truly excavate what I like out of these books. And it would be a challenge.
Well, I can't wait. I consider yourself challenged now. Please do it, Bob Hickok.
You're like 10 hours away from me. I don't need to worry about it.
Right, I know. I'm a brute as well. So speaking of being 10 hours away, there's just one thing that I also wanted to think about with you just for a moment, even though it's a serious thing, because I feel like in Hold, in one of your books, Words for Empty, Words for Full, it feels like you reckoned with the shooting at Virginia Tech.
Yes.
But in Hold, there's violence. There's definite white supremacy. There's police brutality in this book. I don't know. Would you really be mad at me? And again, we're 10 hours away, so I guess I could ask you, because what could you really do, right?
Sure.
Would you read The Class Visit?
That's one I still like, so yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Sure. Class Visit. How many of you have seen a hawk? One hand raised. Who's gone to Disney World? No hands raised. How many of you own a dog? Four hands. Has anyone ever made a snowman? Two hands. Ever seen the Big Dipper? On my grandma's farm, one kid said, his hand up, fingers wiggling. Who knows someone who was shot and killed? Every hand went up, faster than thought, more certain than rain. If you know someone else who was killed, raise your other hand. Had you happened by just then, you'd wonder why so many kids were signaling touchdown, both arms thrown high, or why that class was pretending to be on a roller coaster, arms tossed at the sun as they dropped over the edge of their fake demise, and smile. An actual smile, or just a bit of joy you'd carry on your face down the hall to wherever you were going, making the mood of the next room you entered a little better, even if you didn't know it. I think the pleasure has to do with their hands being so little, yet wanting to hold as much as anyone has ever wanted to hold. Hands are good at that, holding. Hands are good at almost everything we ask them to do.
Thanks, Bob.
Sure.
That one's so lovely and so sad. And you say hold, like some version of hold, three times there.
Yeah.
When did you know that was a thread throughout the book and know that that was what this one would be called?
I don't remember, but what was nice about it was as soon as I thought of the title, it felt right. And there was never... I never gave it another thought, and that's not always the case with titles. And it was only in retrospect, as I really started putting the collection together, that I realized why it had as much appeal as it did.
And why is that, Bob?
For me, maybe the easiest way to speak to that is to go back to the statement you were making a little bit ago about some of the stuff that tends to show up in my poems. When I was a really young, our dog, we had a German Shepherd, he attacked a woodchuck.
Ooh.
And the woodchuck was hurt pretty badly. And I did the remarkably stupid thing of trying to pet the woodchuck because I felt bad for it.
Ooh.
And the woodchuck bit my hand, which I lifted up, and the woodchuck was hanging on. But there's, for whatever reason, wisely, stupidly, I share an impulse that I think most of us have, and that's to reach out to people, particularly people who are having trouble. So the idea of simply holding each other, particularly in these times, let us not talk about the Cheeto-headed person I said I didn't want to talk about at the start of this. It's such a nasty, nasty time. And I think particularly as a white guy, I wanted a book that said something other than what's moving through our culture right now. So.
There's hope here. believe it or not. Thank you, Bob, for talking today. We're at our time, but I hope to talk with you again one day soon.
I would like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Today on Living Writers, Bob Hickok, his book Hold, out with Copper Canyon Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks so much, Bob.
And Joni Mitchell.
And Joni Mitchell for singing.
Ricky
McJones.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Goodbye. Until
Bye.
Next time.
Bye.